everybody. This is a special edition of The Speakeasy. We have a returning guest who I'm sure most of our listeners already know. But if you don't know, we're going to speak a little bit with Ed Chavez, formerly of Vertical Books. That's where most people know him. You might also remember him as the host of the Manga Cast, but now he works for the manga publisher Denpa. He will be talking a little bit about how he's connected to the main character of the manga, which was recently on the air and is getting a second season soon, Gurizeni. Ed, you're always a fascinating person to talk to. You're probably one of the premier manga experts in English in the United States.
That doesn't sound promising for the manga industry in the States, but always a pleasure.
How about this, Ed? You're the people's manga expert.
Yeah, all right, I'll take that. I'll take that. No, but it's fun talking to you again. It's been a little while, I think, but over that hiatus, I suppose, since the last time we spoke. Mm-hmm. I've been across the country to found my own publishing house. I think we'll be talking about that a little later. But first, I think you had a couple questions in regards to that thing that you brought up, Gurizeni, Moneyball.
So just for anybody who does not know you, is not familiar with you from the internets and your many fine pieces of work, could you tell us a little about your history in the manga industry?
Oh, yeah. I'll try to keep this relatively short, but it's kind of lengthy, I suppose, at this time. So I've been in the manga industry for some capacity since about 2004. I guess initially I was just a writer and a reviewer and a reporter on manga and Japanese pop culture, whether that was for Publishers Weekly or a couple other news sources or my blog / podcast, The Manga Cast. I did that for a couple of years before getting approached by few publishers to do translation and editing. Those things combined eventually led to me going to Japan. So after doing a little bit of work with CMX and Seven Seas and a little bit of work with Dark Horse, opportunities kind of arose where I was interacting more and more with the Japanese manga industry, whether it was through interviews that I was setting up or articles that I was writing, or even just programming that I was recording in Japan at, say, like Comic-Con and events like that. More and more I was interacting with Japan, and eventually one of the head editors at Kodansha in Japan offered me an opportunity to collaborate with them in some capacity because they were working on a international manga competition. So when the opportunity came up, thought about it for a little bit and decided just to take off and start helping them translate and market some of that content. I was doing that off and on for about 2.5 years or so. And then another opportunity came up, and that was kind of tied to Kodansha as well, but that wasn't still confirmed quite yet. But I had an opportunity to come back to the States to work for this company called Vertical, where I stayed for 8 years. At the time, they weren't part of the Kodansha group, but they were talking to Kodansha. So the idea there was to bring me over, having worked with Kodansha for so long, not just in a capacity where, you know, I knew a couple titles here and there, but actually knew the editors, I knew the marketing department, I knew members of the licensing team, I knew authors. So I was very familiar with the content, and what they wanted me to do was be able to promote their new expanding, well, back then expanding manga line, because prior to that they were mainly just doing a number of classical works, mainly by Tezuka and Takamiya. They wanted someone there who could not just promote the stuff, but also have some sort of knowledge of what to acquire in that capacity. So that was what I ended up doing for Vertical after a couple of interviews in Japan. And it was almost as if like a trade in some ways, or if I came in like as a package, because in about a year and a half or so, we were deepen conversations with Kodansha about them acquiring Vertical and once again getting integrated back into that culture and starting to work with a lot more of those authors and editors again. 8 years of Vertical, worked on a number of titles over there as the marketing director, sales director, did a lot of editing, translated a handful of series as well, did a little bit of everything. After a while, I kind of thought, maybe it's time to try something new. And that's where I am right now in Portland with Dempa. But I think we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a bit.
Yeah, definitely. But I feel like that's the history that I'd say a bunch of people know, and it's good to reiterate it. But you actually have a little bit of a history with baseball that I don't think most people, other than, maybe some of your closer friends, actually know about.
I was someone who was always really active in sports as a child. Actually, both of my parents played sports at least in college. My mom was a volleyball player. She played basketball. My dad ran track and played a little soccer. Always very active sports fans. I can remember going to Giants games, A's games, soccer matches ever since I was a really, really small kid. And some of my early memories going to the World Cup in Spain, which was 1982. I was like 4 years old. So I started playing baseball, Little League, since I was about 8 years old, and kept on doing that in high in school, a number of leagues, Pony League, Joe DiMaggio League in the Bay Area, until I got into college and went to Cal and played baseball there, and actually had opportunities to get drafted right out of high school. But education was something that was really important to my parents, particularly my mom. She's a teacher. To be honest, I was relatively young at that time. So the best idea or best solution that my family and I had was, just kind of test things out, play a little bit in school, see how that goes, see if there's still the capability there to continue to perform at an increasingly higher level. And, if the opportunity came up, just reevaluate then. And in college, played baseball, played soccer, was asked by the coaches of the cross country team if I wanted to, or I should say the track team, if I wanted to participate in that, and didn't because there were only so many hours in the week. And, Cal isn't slouched for education. Yeah, a couple of years playing with some pretty competitive teammates in a really competitive league, which is back then the six-pack Pac-10 out on the West Coast, playing against schools like Stanford and Arizona State and USC. It was a lot of fun, and it was something that I did relatively well with. And Evans Field was still is a home of mine, and had a real lot of great memories there and excelled relatively well there. And I got an opportunity to play baseball a little bit in the minor leagues. It didn't last very long, fortunately, but got to ride the buses down in the California League, playing for an A's minor league team, and did that for a couple summers. Prior to that, did a little bit of the Cape Cod League while I was in college. Kind of got to see what it's actually like to go out there and actually compete as a ball player. And those pressures are very real. But that was also something that was very motivating at the same time. And a real lot of fun. And also rooming with 25, 26 other dudes for 4 months of the year, for about 6 months with the training and everything, was a ton of fun too. Those are friendships and memories that I still hold very dear today. Not something I end up talking about a lot, I would say, mainly because it didn't necessarily end out very well. Ended up blowing out my shoulder in a cycling accident that I had. And basically, as soon as that happened, I knew I would have some pretty major surgery and a lot of rehab. I just gave it up. And it was kind of sad, I suppose. Never really hit me super hard until I'd say maybe about like 2010, 2012, which was already like more than a decade removed at that point, for the main reason that some of my friends that I was playing with or against in college were now winning trophies. And in that case, like the World Series. And I was just like, wow, it's great to see these guys achieve such things. And what could have been was something that was subtly on my mind. But at the same time, knowing how tough it is to succeed in baseball was more than enough to just be like, okay, well, who knows if we could have even gone that far anyway. So
oddly enough, these two parts of your life have kind of recently, at least to the anime watching audiences, much longer for the manga reading audience, coincided with Gurazeni. Could you explain a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, this story is really, really interesting and kind of full of coincidences, to be honest. So in my time when I was in Japan working for Kodansha, the associate editor-in-chief, so basically like the second man in charge for the magazine I was working for, Morning, Mr. Koizumi, was a big, big baseball fan. And that was something that he and I would talk about quite a bit. And once he found out, he and I started to talk about that quite a bit, because it wasn't something that was common in Japan at the time. This is, I would say, about 2007, 2008 or so. And pretty common, at least amongst baseball fans here in the States, for I'd say maybe 10 years at that point. It was just starting to trickle over to Japan. So people had a lot of questions about how does the game work? How do you value players outside of what they earn? How do you look at a player just via statistics, but not just the basic statistics that people look at, you know, home runs, RBIs, hits, strikeouts? How do you look at the sport in other ways that can evaluate every single one of those stats numerically in a financial way? So these are things that he and I were talking about quite a bit, and we were actually trying to test out, and I introduced him to some fantasy baseball services in the States. And eventually, as our conversations developed and our friendship kind of grew, you know, he ended up kind of realizing that, oh, okay, so you actually not just know a little bit about this because you're a fan, but you've actually played this to an extent. And the thing there kind of expanded out into, you know, we've been thinking about making a baseball manga. Morning has been very successful with a lot of sports manga over the years. I think around that time they were working on Giant Killing, which was a big hit for them and something that they expanded out of just Morning, but they ended up making specific magazines around the world of the characters of Giant Killing to promote Japanese soccer, which was an interesting idea. Interviewing coaches and players and having like their own website dedicated to that as well. So to try to do something similar with a baseball manga, they wanted to go into an angle that wasn't, you know, okay, so we're just going to focus on this specific character and how he's going to be like the best and how he's going to win a championship and maybe the end, but instead kind of look at the world of Japanese baseball from that fantasy baseball perspective. And being a fan, being in the department, he ended up consulting me as well as a couple other editors in the department to come up with this idea that is Disney. And we ended up collaborating with Mr. Adachi, who was the artist for that, and one thing led to another. And I can tell you, I did not expect that thing to last more than 30 volumes. I'm even surprised that it lasted more than 10 volumes, to be honest, because it's a very different type of sports manga, but its origins are literally out of just the interest of a few crazy people.
So the main character is named Banda, and he's, once again, he's very loosely based on your time playing in the minor leagues and basically you and your friend's interests. But how much would you say the character is like you, and how much is it pure fabrication for the manga?
Yeah, so Banda as a character, it's the character itself, its background, its personality, its history, not so much based off of me. So obviously I'm American and you know, a Latino, and Bond is a Japanese person. But where things were kind of taken from my life is Bond is left-handed. Bond's name is also very similar to my favorite baseball player's name, Barry Bonds. Bond's first name is Natsunoke, which is Summer Boy, and my birthday is in the heart of summer, July 17th. Bond looks very much like I do. But actually, that is actually an amalgamation of myself and another editor from that team, Kato Dai, who has more of a fro. But we both wear glasses. Some of those little traits about being very book nerdy and very stubborn when it comes to minutia and statistics and things like that. Those are things that definitely came out of my personality, but also those are things that Koizumi and Kato also really appreciated a lot. And as we ended up building more up on the story, we were really kind of more and more in tune with, hey, why not just run with this a little bit more.
Is any of the character based on that other editor?
So that's a little bit more of like where he's from. But Kato, I don't think played baseball. He's not necessarily like the athletic type. Details like biking to work, which is something that I really wished I could do. Like, I tried doing that, but like where I lived is super far. Like the day-to-day type of things, you know, what his place eventually would look like. Because initially in the manga, he's kind of living in a dorm, or spending time in a dorm. That's kind of taken from Kato's life.
I also assume you never fell in love with a waitress at a Chinese food restaurant who didn't know you existed.
No, that has not happened. That has not occurred, no. What was interesting was in the second arc of Gurazeni, Bonda actually goes to the U.S. to play. And I remember that was an interesting time. I left for Vertical at that point. And I was getting, you know, whenever I had a chance to go back to Japan, there were those moments where it was like, okay, let's go talk to Koizumi and let's get a little bit more information about this specific element of your past. And I remember sitting in those meetings with not just like Kodansha editors and the author for the series, but also a couple of baseball agents, Japanese baseball agents that were present too. And it was an interesting back and forth from that regard, just being like, hey, so you live in this situation where you've got very meager wages. You do get small stipends here to, you know, feed yourself and kind of dick around at the hotel, you know, if you want to get a candy bar or a beer or something, if you're old enough. But it's not very fancy lifestyle in the minor leagues. And that was something that they were very interested in, because it was a time when a couple of major Japanese players had gone over to Japan, and they struggled. You know, not everyone was like Hideo Nomo or Hideki Matsui that immediately came over to Major League Baseball and was a smashing hit. A few of those Japanese stars, and they were big stars in Japan, had to go into the minor leagues, or in some cases decided not to do that at all and just went back to Japan, which is kind of what ended up happening with Bonda after a little bit. So that type of thing ended up coming back into the story, even with me no longer being at Kodansha full time. It still ended up creating a situation where, yeah, you know, let's try to cater certain elements for entertainment value, obviously, but still bring in inspiration from reality, which I thought was pretty cool.
Since you kind of touched on it already, American baseball and Japanese baseball, I mean, they follow a lot of the same rules, but they're obviously not 100% the same. Mm-hmm. What do you think are some major differences, and do any of them affect Gurazeni in ways that people who are not big fans of baseball in both countries might not know?
I think the biggest thing is, and this is something that I think fans when they first, or people who were watching Gurazeni when it first came out may have been really confused about, was pay. You're a Major League Baseball player. Your base salary, your minimum salary is, I think at this point, about $530,000 a year, if you're actually on a major league roster. And, you know, ball players make more than $20 million a year in the States. Those wages are not like that in Japan. And I know people got really confused in regards to exchange rates over there when watching Moneyball and seeing, oh, Bonda's complaining when he's talking about earning 10 million yen a year. You know, that's $100,000 a year or so. Yes, $100,000 a year is something that I would love to see. I think most people listening to this podcast would love to earn. But for a baseball player, as Bonda describes in that comic, it's, I won't say that's hard living, but it's something that you have to keep in the back of your head because you're only going to earn that much money for so much time. And even the best baseball players in Japan are not earning tens of millions of dollars just by being a baseball player. A number of them are signing contracts in regards with their sponsors for things, or doing special events, or appearing on TV shows as talent to an extent. That's a big part of that life over there. Financially, there's a big difference. Another difference, and this is touched on a little bit more in the anime than in the manga, is minor league baseball. Major leagues out here in the U.S., there are, outside of the majors, there are up to 5 levels of minor league baseball, I think. Let's see, AAA, AA, Single-A, rookie ball. I think there's just short league rookie and long league rookie. It's either 4 or 5 right now. And then there's expanded minor leagues in Venezuela, that's run by Major League Baseball, and the Dominican Republic. So those are mainly played by younger players in those countries, but there are veterans under those circumstances. Those are affiliated with Major League Baseball teams. In Japan, every Major League level, sort of the top level of Japanese baseball, has one minor league team, and that's it. And there's a lot of semi-pro baseball in Japan. A number of those things are kind of quasi-operated or funded by Japanese, like big Japanese industry. Some major conglomerates over there may fund teams like that. But when it comes to just straight up minor league baseball, there is basically the Nigumi, the second team, and that's it. So things get really competitive under those circumstances. And I'm not going to say that Japan doesn't love baseball as much as the States, because it surely does. And Japan doesn't bring out or create as many players as the States, because in some ways it might actually have a higher percentage, because obviously in the States we get players from Japan, we get players from Korea, we get players from the Dominican, Puerto Rico, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Panama, et cetera, Canada, Mexico. That's not necessarily happening to that same frequency in Japan. So it's very domestic, though there are people who are brought in. There are foreign players that are brought in to every Japanese top level team. That type of world, that baseball is way more competitive. It's more competitive, and at the same time, they're not getting paid that well. So it's a very, very stressful, very challenging type of situation for those people. And I feel, even though Gurazenia doesn't necessarily go into that much detail about that, mainly because it's focusing on Bonda and his teammates and that world, when it does bring it up, those scenes, especially in the anime, are pretty heavy. You can tell that those players who have to go up and down and up and down between the top team and the minor league team, they're very frustrated, and there's a lot of fear under those circumstances. And that's one of the things that I think a lot of people in the West may not know anything about, to be honest.
Plus, as you said, your shelf life isn't that long as it is. So if you spend most of your time in the minor league, you're earning not that much money, with the hope that maybe one day you'll get your break or that lucky streak that will get you the decent money, if not the real money.
Gurazenia does a really good job with that, of being like, okay, so there are a couple of players that know that they have to cash in on that big contract for a year, whether it's that first year signing bonus contract or they get a call up and the coach is like, all right, so we're going to start you from day one this season. So we're not going to give up on you immediately. So you're going to get paid, but what's your next contract going to be like? And you know, Gurazenia does a good job of showing how they have to compete. And most of the time, it's really the big difference between being a star and not being a star that shows you what your resilience is going to be. And you know, if you watch Gurazenia, especially in the early episodes, you'll see a number of characters just show up for an episode or two at the most, and they're just you know, then they're referenced again by Bonda being like, okay, so those guys are back in the minor leagues. But it was, you know, it was fun to see them for a while.
Yeah, I'm just curious if you know, did they ever get into like somebody who just totally is a utter spendthrift, not realizing that they have a Firefly career?
Strangely enough, like Bonda doesn't spend his money much at all. I mean, in the manga, he's really, really frugal. And it's mainly because he's in a situation where he's a specialist type of player to begin with. So most teams need a player like him, but players like him are very common. The only difference between him and other players that are in a similar category is whether he can thrive under pressure for long enough. And that's kind of what his personal struggle is like. So I think that's one of the reasons why he's very studious about the game, even though I'm not going to say that baseball players aren't, because actually a lot of them are pretty much nerds to a certain capacity. But the way that Bonda takes it, and his coaches in particular kind of pick on him for that reason, is sometimes he obsesses over it a little bit too much. And that might put him in a position where it might impact him in a negative way. And baseball players are kind of creatures of habit. So, like, they're very, sadly, we're very superstitious. So it's very hard to snap out of those habits. And the, once again, the thing about Gorazene is that it also show how ingrained that part of the culture is. So it's not to say that characters like Bonda are very thrifty or frugal, because that's their personality. You know, I mean, maybe Bonda's case, maybe I'll pull that back. But I think baseball players, for the most part, kind of want to live a nice little cush life. but in Bonda's case, yeah, like he knows that his cush life is possibly most likely gonna be best impacted later when he's not gonna be earning big salaries. So characters like that are, I won't say they're few and far between in that series, but I think they do pop up here and there. But Bonda's pretty much the source of that specific point throughout that title.
So how many people knew about your connection to Gorazene before the anime came out? And do you think that's changed since the anime's come out?
Okay, so that's a fun question for me, because obviously people at Kodansha kind of knew. And as I started working for Vertical in particular, that information at Kodansha, especially in Japan, was slowly creeping through. And that's mainly because Gorazene was becoming more and more popular over there. Like, the first volume, I think, came out around the time that I moved to New York. And then as I started to do licensing for Vertical, and Kodansha was one of the publishers I was courting very early on, with titles like Cheese Sweet Home and Pipochu and Drops of God, eventually a lot of those licensing meetings were like, oh, hey, I hear your comic's doing really well. And I'm like, what exactly do you mean? And why are we having this conversation right now? And eventually it was mainly people in the business that ended up realizing this. So first, my old editor-in-chief, Yanni, who you've met, came back from a meeting from a week of meetings in Japan, and he was like, oh, hey, everyone's talking about your comic. Have they been sending you copies of the book? And I'm like, and eventually the licensing manager at Dark Horse Comics, Michael Gombos, would hit me up on my personal Twitter and was like, oh, hey, Ed, I see you're on the cover of the latest morning. And so it started to kind of trickle through that. I remember some members of ADV Sentai asking me those questions as well. So early on, I would say before the anime came out, it was mainly insiders. And things started to kind of develop a little bit more as merchandise started coming out. And not just people within the industry, but critics and columnists and writers that tend to be a little more attuned to that type of thing, following not just manga in general, maybe following sports manga and figures to an extent, started catching on to that. After the anime came out, to be honest, it was more just like, wow, like every single personal friend that I had that's a weeb and watched that show, they would immediately just like text me or hit me up on social media and say, dude, is this about you? And Were randos coming up to me about it? Not so much. And I think that might just kind of twofold. For a long time, I had a lot of my social media kind of locked down, so I wasn't so accessible to a lot of people. Also, I don't know. I've got a weird personality when it comes to, I'm not super social in public to begin with, but outside of my circles. In contrast to that, when I do interact on social media, I'm not necessarily talking about anime or manga half the time. It's more just randomness. And so maybe people don't make that association. The dude who looks like Gurazeni and has a Gurazeni icon, the guy who's on the covers of the magazine every July, is the same person. And I'm totally fine with that. That doesn't bother me at all. I'd honestly rather, I don't know, I'm not sure if I would rather less people know, but I think I'm totally fine with the amount of awareness that's out there right now, I think.
And I guess that all your pictures of delicious food on your Twitter feed don't engender, oh, by the way, the main character of manga in mourning is based on me.
That and cat pictures and random like beer tweets. Yeah, I'm not sure if people are easily going to make that additional step from there.
So has Moritaka or Studio Dean ever contacted you about doing something for Gurazeni?
No, actually, that, to be honest, is a little bit of a surprise to me, just because of how much there was that conversation early on. And like I said, even after I moved from Vertical, there was a conversation, at least with Kodansha. But, I mean, I was told that there was going to be an anime pretty early on in the process of like anime development, but speaking with Dean or any of their staff, that's never come up actually. I'm not necessarily sure if it's because it's, you know, I'm not in Japan, or to be honest, you know, think it is kind of loosely based, so they can kind of work with what they have, and I think that works just fine with them. I mean, even looking at what has been adapted and how that's kind of a little bit of picking and choosing parts of stories. Yeah, I think the way that they've kind of done that is just fine with me. I think they really didn't need to consult me on anything or even bring it up for that matter. I'm just happy that it's available, to be honest.
Maybe if it ever gets licensed for like home video in the US, somebody will do an interview as a special feature.
Yeah, that would be cool. I know some people were just like, if this was ever dubbed, I should voice it. I thought that'd be hilarious. I'm not sure how well I would react to something like that, to be honest, but yeah.
Look, man, my tool does it, you can too.
Exactly. I could be baseball anime's Banyanyan. Now you've talked me into it.
Now we know who to stunt cast. Excellent. If Funimation or Sentai picks it up, I'll be sure to tweet it every day. And if Discotech picks it up, I'm sure Mike Tool will. You'll be the first person he taps.
Yeah. Nice.
Speaking of merchandise and, you know, your connection, the anime has upped the amount of merchandise. Not that there wasn't any merchandise because of the manga, but like now Banda has like several Revoltex with like home uniform and visitor's uniform and like other team uniforms.
Yeah.
Has anybody bought you Banda merch as a gift? And have you gone out and bought any Banda merchandise just to be like, that's me?
Yeah, no, I don't think I can do that. I think that's possibly crossing a line for me. Sadly, no one's given me a Banda Revoltex so far. I have had moments where I've wanted to get Banda jerseys, the actual like jerseys that they've been kind of promoting, specifically when promoting the anime. I think it's Studio Dean, or maybe it was the network. They were doing some events with the voice actors, and generally Banda's voice actor would dress up in a Banda jersey, and I always thought that was pretty cool. So maybe next time I should have asked already, to be honest, but maybe next time I go out there, I can look around for, or just inquire with Kodansha to see what their situation is.
So Ed, just in case any of our listeners really like you, what's your size if they wanted to get you a jersey?
I'll take a large, or if, I don't know how they size those. Maybe if they're in actual baseball terms, I think I'm a 42, but yeah, I'll take a large. It doesn't have to say Bond on the back. I'm fine with just the Spiders jersey or the Mops jersey, because later on he's playing for the Mops. Either one works.
but as just Ed Chavez, man of doujinshi. Have you ever looked at Gurazani Dojin? Because I know that has to be Gurazani Dojin.
Oh, yeah. That's true. Another hat that I wear. No, actually. I have to say, for me, that is pretty lask on my part. But I haven't been to a Dojin event in Japan since 2010, mainly because Summer Comic-Con is generally the weekend of Otakon, and I've been going to Otakon practically every year since I started working at Vertical, and I've been to the last two Otakon ever since I moved out west again, so I haven't had an opportunity to go to Summer. Maybe next year. Next year, I think the dates have changed, so that might open something up.
Otakon is like late July next year.
Yeah, that's right. And in regards to winter, yeah, it's tough. I like winter comic a lot, but it being over Christmas, New Year's break is also tricky. I was living in New York for a long time, 8 years. Those are the only opportunities I would get to go see my family, really, out in San Francisco. So, well, not to say that I couldn't go to other, smaller doujin events in Japan when I would travel out there. For some reason, not too many Gurazani-only events out there. They might exist. I haven't run into it yet. I'm sure it exists. It must. Everything is a doujin. I know this as a fact. I haven't had a chance to experience any of it yet.
I'm also just a little surprised no one's ever got you that one as a gag gift.
Yeah, no, that would have been good. I think it's just, I'm not going to say that sports manga isn't popular, because it's actually super popular within the doujin community. Once you start moving into seinen sports manga, not as much. Actually, a lot of seinen, unless it's kind of on the extremes. What I mean by that is either super violent or kind of super sexy or something, or has a really weird hook, isn't gonna get a lot of doujin, especially fan comics. So I think it would be a little bit of a challenge to run into a Gurazani doujin, but pretty certain it exists. Never had a chance to run into it.
Oh, and to wrap up this section, which has been your favorite Gurazani story from the anime or the manga? And is there some aspect of baseball that you wish they would touch upon?
I think my favorite one was, I'll bring up an anime one because I think it's a little easier for fans to experience this. The episode with the minor league player who was kind of drawn to look like Felipe Smith, of all things, who's also a very, very close friend of the artist for the series. A big, tall guy, very, very energetic, very, very genki, very enthusiastic, wants to stay in Japan, but kind of is struggling getting used to not just baseball culture there, but also just Japanese culture there. And he needs help getting from his dorm, which is not anywhere near the stadium or the practice. Actually, I think it's close to the practice field, and might not read Japanese all that well, so it gets lost ever so often. Those type of situations. And I remember that episode also discussed, minor leaguers are not allowed to get driver's licenses over there because their teams contractually don't want them to get into auto accidents because they're driving on the opposite side of the road, which is an actual legitimate problem with people coming from other countries to drive there. But so in that case, there were a lot of little very, very intricate details in the writing for that episode that I think maybe went over a lot of people's heads. It was really subtle, but I thought it was really thoughtful. It was also kind of slow at times, but I thought that was also well thought out. If people haven't had a chance to check that one out, I'd really recommend that episode. And as far as an aspect of baseball that I wish would be covered, I think, interacting a little bit more with established foreign players there. So that's something that's kind of touched on occasionally in the story, but strangely enough, some of those players tend to be some of the better paid players on Japanese teams. Be interesting to go into what their day-to-day lives are instead of as a minor leaguer or call-up or a rookie, because their lives you know, those guys are going to be, you know, on TV, and those guys are going to be doing events within the baseball community, but also within the foreigner community. And they're interacting with foreigners. And a lot of those foreign players tend to also hang out a lot together as kind of like a support system, you know, dealing, also be interested in that part of just like interpreters and agents for those athletes as well, because it's this other little world that is a part of the day to day in Japanese baseball, but it's not dug into that deep. And I think even for Japanese fans, people would, I think, be curious or find some new little tidbits to take away from that.
A bunch of players who are never alone in being alone.
Yeah, and in the spotlight, unlike some of, like the episode I described before, I mean, that guy is, you know, he's a rookie and he was being tossed up from the minors to the majors, so his pressures are very different. But in regards to the stars, their pressure is just to perform, which is something that the Gurizani touches on with like some of the bigger Japanese stars. But the fact that some of them might not have their families with them, the fact that some of them may not have much of a network or a safety net outside of their other foreign players or their agents or even just like their teammates who may have a little hard time communicating with them. You know, I think those things are kind of would be pretty insightful. I don't know.
Let's talk a little bit about your new company, which I'm sure a lot of our listeners possibly they're like, all right, we got through the Gurizani talk. Now give us the Denpa talk. But how did this company come about?
Oh, wow. How did it come about? About a year and a half ago, while I was still in New York, I was approached via email about some licensing issues that another company was having. And that conversation ended up kind of snowballing into, oh, man, like, you know all these people. You already have these connections. Man, if you can only start up your own business. And those are things that were like in the back of my mind already for a bit, but I never thought up until that point that I could achieve that, at least in the immediate future. And a little while later, that same person ends up getting back to me like, you know, why don't we see if we can do this together? And that was Jacob from Faku who you brought up before. And I thought it over for a little bit, took in a bit of like, all right, so where am I going to be going with Vertical from here on out? After doing a little like mental accounting, was like, well, I don't know how many chances I'm going to have like this pop up. So why don't we give it a shot? And yeah, flew out here last May and was helping Faku out with some of their issues, getting them onboarded with a couple of vendors and some wholesalers, and having them talk to a couple more publishers in Japan. And eventually it was just like, all right, I've got my plan ready. Let's put down some money and let's fly to Japan and let's get things rolling. And it was interesting for me because one of the things that was kind of in the back of my head all that time was, are my old connections, and this is not just from licensing, but like everything. Are my old connections in the printing industry? Are my old connections in retail and at cons? The old authors that I used to deal with, translators. Are these people going to be on board just with me and not with me and Vertical? Most of them were okay with it. And the first dominoes there were like going to Japan and meeting up with publishers there. And even before I saw them, like as I was trying to schedule these meetings, a good number of them were like, thank God you're back. Thank goodness you're still doing this. With a couple of them being like, nobody else talks to us or looks at our books or looks at these type of books. And that gave me some hope. After the first round of meetings in Japan, it was like, all right, so there's a lot to fix. And I went back again in January. So first round was in September. I went back in January and came back with a updated proposal. And by then, almost all the publishers that we're working with right now are on board. And by then, we even had one of those publishers come out to Portland to come see me in person, which I can tell you, even when I was at Vertical, there were a couple publishers who would do that, but that took a while. Outside of Kodansha, and obviously they owned Vertical, but you know, it took a while until some of the people that we were courting or even partnered with would come see us, and I was very touched by it. So
yeah,
since then it's been work, kind of wearing two hats, you know, trying to run DEPA as his own business and still doing some kind of big projects for FAKU, but not so much day-to-day stuff there. Here we are, just announced it publicly a couple of weeks ago, and you know, now getting books up in for pre-order in stores and Diamond and the like, getting pretty close to getting things out. That's pretty cool.
So you mentioned you had two hats. What is your actual DEPA hat? What is your actual role at DEPA other than Ed Chavez, old guy?
Yeah. I'm the publisher here. Chief Operating Officer. There's only two of us full time here. So the other person is my production lead. So right now that means doing all the contracts and communicating with Japan, communicating with vendors, communicating with translators and letterers and setting up deals with printers and, you know, sharing duty on social media. So it's a little bit of everything. So I guess when you're that small of a team, you kind of have to do a little bit of everything.
So you mentioned that you announced pretty much the birth of DEPA at Otakon, but it was at Otabrew, which is in many ways just a Otakon drinking party. Did you feel that was a risky announcement, or did you feel that kind of doesn't matter in this modern internet age?
No, it was risky. It was risky. I mean, it's not as if I didn't ask Otakon to have a panel there. It was kind of a calculated risk, to be honest. The thing there was, I knew who was coming. I knew what their reach was. Why not take advantage of that? The only thing that, like, where I was kind of a little doubtful was, would they react positively to me taking time out of basically was a get together, 60 people. And then thankfully things worked out. People were very curious. Now, not everybody immediately went on to Twitter or Snapchat or whatever. It was like, hey, this is the next big thing and everybody needs to sign on. Enough people did, and I'm eternally grateful for all that. I'm glad it worked out. Could I have just sent out a press release? Yeah, I don't think it would have had the same impact, but that's just me. I could easily be wrong.
Since you're a maverick of the industry, Ed, what is your general philosophy about DEPA titles, and what should we expect from your selection of titles?
That's something that a lot of people ask, and it's complicated. My tastes vary a lot, and I don't think you can actually, I have a hard time just pinning down that myself. What I would generally say, at least initially, the readers are going to be able to see high quality narrative works that are from, I won't say the fringes of manga, because none of these are just like indie releases, but from the nooks and crannies, from the nooks, I should say, of publishing that have been underserved. And, you know, whether it's, you know, dashes of Jose or modern day classics, like say a Kaiji. Kaiji isn't 40 years old. It's not from the origins of manga, but it is a title that came out in the 90s and strangely enough, still running today. I can tell you that most people don't look at titles like that from a licensing perspective these days. I mean, sure, Viz can re-release Ranma, but that's a re-release. And Ranma is actually one of their more popular titles historically. Are they releasing Omrice? Are they going to finish Pat Labor? Maybe not. Maybe they will. I don't know. But we're not necessarily seeing things like that. We're not very artsy, high concept works like Invitation from a Crab. That's like a strange art style that looks more attuned with Western indie comics than it does with Japanese art. And then there are going to be titles like Inside Mari, you know, that I don't know why it was never published in print in the States. It's not as if Oshimi isn't popular. He did well for Vertical. I know he's doing well for Kodansha with his latest series, Happiness. But for whatever reason, that title slipped through the cracks after being on Crunchyroll. And, you know, things like that deserve a chance. I'm not going to say that I'm going to go look through Mal Comic, Kodansha's direct to digital only releases, or specifically comb through Crunchyroll's digital-only titles. But you know, I think there are going to be opportunities for things like that, too, that are quality, that are from genres that aren't given as much attention here, even though they're very prominent overseas. We're going to give those opportunities for people to experience them not only in print, but in digital. We're going to try to provide some really good editions of both as well. So it's hard for me to like pin down exactly what we're going to be doing, but I don't expect things to be very standard. Like, I don't expect things to just be like another shonen action title or another isekai title. Those are things you can find someplace else, and they can do much better for those titles than I can possibly do.
So you're not getting, I was transported to a world filled with nothing but my little sisters. Ah, well.
Not this year. And if that was maybe written, if that was like a Josei title, maybe, but not likely.
But you mentioned you had a few titles very diverse in your initial lineup. What can you say about those initial titles?
I don't want to eat up a real lot of time because there's like six or seven of them, but yeah, a little bit of everything. So we've got Future Log by Range Murata, the character designer for Last Exile and Blue Submarine number 6. That's an art book that's coming out hopefully later this year, if not beginning of next year. Full color, 280 pages worth, magazine sized, with about 15 pull-out posters, gatefold posters, a couple of dust jackets, including PVC vinyl clear dust jacket on top of that, that collects 20 years worth of his art and character art, line art, some conceptual art as well as about a half dozen comics of his that he's worked on over the years. Good chunk of that came from Robot, a series that he used to, an anthology series he used to edit. So that's one of the books. Another title, it's kind of slightly connected to that, is Pez by Hiroyuki Asada, the creator of Letter B. It's a full-color, shown in all ages title that shows a kind of like a post-apocalyptic world and a couple of characters who are traveling this landscape with quasi-cyborg bodies. They're trying to look for civilization. Really touching. Very, very cute. Talk about Inside Mari. So that's series from Shuzo Oshimi, the Flowers of Evil guy. It's a gender-swapping, body-swapping title about a college student who, college dropout, I should say, who one day finds himself in the body of a high school girl. And he has to work with the gal's classmates, quasi-friends, to try to find the gal and maybe find a way back into his own body. Let's see, what else do we have?
Oh, just one quick question about that one.
Yeah.
Are you using the Crunchyroll translation or are you doing your own?
Actually, we're working with the Crunchyroll translator, so we're kind of re-editing that, and we've re-lettered it entirely, so it's got a brand new treatment. But yes, we're working with Sheldon on that title. It's kind of revised. It's possibly it's been a couple years since you've worked on that, so I think it's a good opportunity to give it a little sprucing up. See, after that we have Pampanya's An Invitation from a Crab, which is basically an anthology of his short slice of life comics, as well as some doujinshi he wrote, that basically forces the reader to really pay attention to the mundane little details in the background. It's a collection of shorts that seem, when they start off, to be just like, okay, so this is everyday life, and all of a sudden, yeah, every day may be a lot more exciting than you might think. And when rendered with Pampanya's art, I think you get even more reason to just kind of sit down and really focus and look really closely at all the little details that you might see in life. And it's got a bunch of essays, too, from Pampanya that he's written over the years that kind of go into a little more detail about that and how come he has this interesting perspective on just the mundane, basically. Then we've got Maiden Railways, a Jose title by Sumiko Nakamura, who wrote Utsubora and Classmates. It's another anthology, a collection of short stories, each one about a romance set on trains or in train stations. Romances could be really fleeting at times. Sometimes they develop over a course while riding on a train. Interesting stuff, like that has a real lot of range in regards to the characters themselves. So you have, you know, high school kids, you have women and young men in their 20s coming into their relationships. You have older women couples as well, kind of confronting what it means to have love these days, you know, whether it's with each other or just kind of defining that as part of a community. So, you know, what Asumiko does is take a couple of two very broad topics, trains and romance, and kind of builds off of that in a way that I think is going to be really surprising to people, because it's not your standard Josei title. It's also not your standard romance title as well. It's got a little bit for women in general, whether you're young, you're old, yeah, and even in regards to affiliation, gender wise, and sexual preference too. So that's pretty interesting in my opinion. Oh, and then there's this title called Kaiji, which I think is a little bit of a risk. Kind of a gambling title. That's about all I'm going to say about Kaiji, because I'm kind of running out of steam.
No, that's fine. It's clearly just what you're licensing to pave the way for Jin to Ken. I gotcha.
Yeah, exactly. God. So far, a real lot of attention to Kaiji. That's possibly been the title that most people are really excited about, at least if social media has shown me anything. I mean, that's a title that I've enjoyed for a long time, and one that I bring up to people in Japan now that, you know, we've made it public, and they're like, wow, that in of itself is going to be a gamble. But you know, we'll be working on the first arc of that, the original 13 volumes of Gambling Apocalypse, and releasing that in an omnibus edition. So instead of 13 volumes, people are going to get like 520 page books. Yeah, should be pretty fun.
Speaking of which, are you doing any special promotions or projects for your initial titles?
What do you mean?
Like special editions or anything like that? Or, hey man, we just got to get these titles out there. We'll worry about what gets a special edition down the line.
Technically, Pez and Future Log are special editions. Honestly, I don't especially with like Future Log, I don't know how many reprints, if we're going to be doing reprints at all. That is a massive, very expensive book to make. When people see it, I think they're kind of going to be surprised how insane that book is. So if you're a fan of Murata or just like want to see high quality art books, get that as soon as you can, because not sure how you can actually do more of that specific release. And that's already in process of getting printed right now. So Pez is another situation too. We're doing that with like a dust jacket and emboss cover. Dust jacket's original cover, brand new just for us. And being full color, weird page count. Yeah, that one's a big challenge just to put out. So not so much in regards to it's too expensive, but it's just such a unique book that I'm not too sure what the longevity is going to be on that one also. Maybe we release that in a more traditional way later, but those two are definitely special editions from the get-go. The rest, I don't know, maybe down the line we'll do something. Maybe Omnibus Mari down the line. I'm not guaranteeing anything right now. Depending on how well that does, I don't know. You know, Kaiji, those are already going to be Omnibus editions, but they're paperbacks. I think for a title like that, it's enough of a challenge just to get it out. And on top of that, I want to see if there's enough demand to do more of Kaiji. So the concern there is Kaiji's more than 60 volumes as, you know, in its entirety. So getting through all that is not going to be easy no matter what. Spending more money to produce something like that is going to be very hard on the customer. So I don't want to be in a situation where some of the books are high end and some of the books are not. So I'd rather just start off with like things being consistent. And if things work out, who knows? Maybe a box set, maybe something like that. I don't know. At least initially, we'll try to make these omnibus look as nice as possible.
Since you are getting the Murata art book, are you looking to license anything that's not strictly manga?
Yeah. I mean, art books are something that is going to continue to be in the back of our minds. We get a lot of questions about light novels right now, and I would say maybe down the line, I'm basically doing all the editorial for this right now. So it's taking enough of my time just to edit two books a month without adding a novel to it. And that, you know, manga has a lot less text than a novel. We don't have that capacity. On the flip side, an art book, not a lot of text for the most part. Range has some comics in it and does have a couple essays in it. So, and some poems as well. So that, you know, that required a little bit of translating. But outside of the actual production process and color proofs and just making sure that everything looks good, it's pretty easy. Color correcting is a pain in the butt, but it's a lot easier than sitting down for a couple weeks editing a novel. Maybe down the line, what I've been saying to people online is, if we can prove this concept that is Dempa as is currently, and I can get to the point where we expand our catalog and we expand our staffing situation, that's when we'll start thinking about things like that. But I think in the meantime, we're just going to focus on comics and art books.
You know, since you brought up the Age of Kaiji, are you looking at any old manga titles for future releases?
Yeah, we are. It's kind of funny when you get into the licensing business and you start going after titles like that, because then publishers are just immediately, okay, so you've done this thing, let's compare it with that, and would you like to try this? This came from the same era or around the same time. So yeah, we're looking at those things. You know, right now, as I said before, like our capacity is just kind of, it is what it is. We don't have real lot of hands on deck here. Like, they're all of the ones that we have are grinding. But once we're done with Kaiji, which is in, I guess, about 2 years, that might be a good time to slot in something else that's classic. Where I would possibly see more of that action occur would be if we do any one-shots. It's just a little easier under those circumstances to kind of slot something in. What is always a problem with these things, and is a problem with Kaiji also, is files. And file situation for Kaiji, they're not great. So that is requiring a lot of work internally. So it just takes more time to work with something that's older. Slotting something in just for like a one shot and just kind of coming in and coming out and doing one or two of those a year is doable. Obviously schedules are going to dictate whether we do that or not, but it's something we're considering for sure.
How will people be able to buy these titles? Since you mentioned you're still setting up certain distribution channels.
Yeah. And right now, easiest way would be through Diamond. You have a local comic shop. We're in the latest catalog right now, so we have our first two books in there. That should be the case from here on out. That's one of the options. Right Stuff is already selling us as well, so people can pre-order those books there as right now if they would like. We're working with Powell's, so we should get onboarded with them relatively soon. They're a local bookstore chain up in Northwest over here, but they do have a pretty good online presence too, so those are options. We're working to get on board with Amazon right now. That's a little bit of a process, but I think we're going to get that settled relatively soon, so readers should look forward to that within the next month or so. Eventually, people will be able to go to the Dempa website as well, dempa.pub. We'll be selling through there. Conventions, we'll be attending some throughout the coming year. Yeah, hopefully with enough word of mouth and enough legwork on my part, at some point we'll be able to get into chains. But right now, places that I just listed are your best bets.
All I could also think is it's denpa.pub for publisher, not for the drinking house. Although I'm sure if you could sell your manga at local bars, you'd be very happy.
I would be very happy, yeah.
So my last question is the most stinky. What do you think is the future of the company? And what do you think is the future of manga in general?
I would hope to see like Dempa as a business kind of continue to grow with what we've set out to do. And that's kind of look for underserved authors and titles and genres. Hopefully in the next couple of years, you know, start building out from, instead of one or two books a month, get to the point where we're doing three or four. And, you know, if that works out, expand some more, maybe do other types of books as well. It's really modest. I don't plan on taking over the world with this. I don't think that's reasonable.
You don't expect next year to be going head to head with Viz?
No. Well, yes, but I don't think it'll be likely. So. And then in regards to like the future of manga in general, I think I'm glad things have improved so much over the years. I don't think I've had moments of pessimism in regards to that. I don't think I would venture on my own if that were the case. I don't think I would have done what I accomplished at Vertical if that were the case either. You know, I hope we continue as an industry just to try new things, to look into new genres, talk to new publishers. I still feel that there's a lot of sameness in that regard. And maybe it's just because, you know, certain publishers kind of dominate, and that's what their parent companies tend to do for the most part. But I think even under those circumstances, those businesses have opportunities to do other things. They have access to so much more. And if we're capable as a whole to do that, I think the industry is going to be able to survive a lot of things, whether it's issues economically or any issues that may pop up in distribution. I think having a more robust, a broader, more balanced type of industry as a whole can overcome whatever shortcomings may arise that we are not directly dictating, because publishing is not a bubble. There are a lot of factors within the industry. You know, if anything happens to those things, I think if we collectively make the right decisions on what we license, how we license, where we sell, how we sell, I think we can overcome those things. So I'm hoping the future is continued growth and continued diversity and continued fun.
Well, thanks, Ed. That was like super informative, both about Gurzeni and your new line, Denpa.
Yeah.
I hope that works out for you. You have some really strong titles. I think if anything, your years are vertical, and just your years being, like I said, the manga industry expert of the people, I feel like you're a name that could be trusted, and that I think these titles will offer a lot to the fandom, especially people looking for something a little outside of the ordinary.
Yeah, I hope so. I think there are opportunities for success, whether it's for these type of titles, whether it's from us or whether it's from other publishers. And I appreciate the kind words in regards to me personally in that regard, because as a publisher or just like an insider in general, it's one thing to kind of gauge things in regards to sales, but I don't think that's like the only way you can see health or positivity. So, you know, hearing that from someone like you or the public is always gratifying.
So, Ed, before you go, I heard you had one last announcement to make.
Before I head off to dinner, I wanted to announce something that I think maybe some of your listeners in particular, maybe Kate would really appreciate this, because I know she's a big fan. But we have a new title to announce, something that I think fans might be familiar with. So this isn't super fringy, but it does have its moments. It's a Type Moon work.
It's Kawaii.
No, it's not that.
It's Kawaii.
Drat, I should have done that. No, I failed. Instead, we have the rights to today's menu for the Emiya family.
That is a big get and a big announcement for reverse themes, of all things.
As I'm sure you know, there's an anime for that currently available on Crunchyroll, quite beautifully rendered right now, that focuses on all your favorite fate characters going over to Shiro's place to eat stuff, which is basically how all the fate stories should. But yeah, what are your thoughts, man?
Oh, that's crazy great. I assume the hardest part will be translating the recipes. I've heard that's like the hardest part of any kind of cooking manga like that.
Each chapter does come up with like an actual recipe that you can follow. So yeah, that's going to be a little bit of a challenge. Thankfully for me, I edited cookbooks and I was at Vertical, so I won't say that it's going to be like a one-to-one type of deal there where this is going to be easy peasy, but so yeah, a little bit of a foodie in my spare time too, so really looking forward working on this title.
I'm very much looking forward to buying this title.
Should be coming out, I think, spring of next year, and yeah, us kind of dipping our toes into the Type Moon universe, and we'll see how it goes. We're looking into more titles from this franchise too. So, you know, if this does well,
keep my fingers crossed for Fate School Life. I gotcha.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, Melty Blood, I'm sure you're really excited about too. The opportunities are endless. I'm curious how that's going to work out, but I think people are going to be pretty excited about it.
If there is a title that is both Type Moon and Ed, it is Emiya Menu.
Yeah.
Thanks for your time, Ed, and thanks for that license.
Yeah, no problem. Specifically for Reverse Thieves fans.